Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the next 2 weeks, we will look at presidential candidates' records, policy plans, and donors. We are kicking off the series today by talking about former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He was first elected mayor in November 2011 when he was just 29 years old. He took office in January 2012 and served for 8 years. He also served as a U.S. Navy Reserve officer from 2009 to 2017. In 2014, he took a leave of absence as mayor to serve for 7 months in Afghanistan. The 38-year-old is the first openly gay Democrat to run for president. In the Iowa caucus, Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders nearly tied in state delegates. And in the New Hampshire presidential primary, he came in a close second to Bernie Sanders. Most people had never even heard of Pete Buttigieg last year, and his campaign so far has raised a whopping $75 million. He has spent over $60 million, leaving him with $14.5 million on hand, according to Open Secrets. 40 billionaires have donated to Pete Buttigieg's campaign, according to Forbes. They include former Trump supporter Jennifer Pritzker, who inherited a chunk of the Hyatt Hotel's fortune. More than one-third of Buttigieg's wealthy benefactors got rich in finance and investments. That group includes seven who built their fortunes from hedge funds. Pete Buttigieg has also received support from the tech industry. His donors include Wendy Schmidt, the wife of former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, and Netflix chief executive Reed Hastings. According to the New York Times, one of his top funders is Hamilton James, executive vice chair of the Blackstone Group, a private equity fund headed by Stephen Schwarzman, who's an advisor to Donald Trump. Joining us to talk about Pete Buttigieg and his donors is Sarah Jones, a writer at New York Magazine. She covers politics and culture, and previously she was a reporter for The New Republic. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Unfortunately, we live in a time where these candidates really have no choice but to raise so much money because The Hill reported in January that the Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee raised a whopping $154 million just in the fourth quarter of last year. And CNN just reported a few days ago that in January they raised $60 million. So the Democrats have no choice but to raise a lot of money because the ads are expensive, campaigning is expensive. But where they get the money is really important. And you looked into that in the story you wrote about Pete Buttigieg. What really stood out for you about where he's getting his money?
Sure. You know, as you mentioned, it does take a lot of money to run for office, really at any level, whether you're running for state office or for Congress and, of course, president. It's extremely expensive. But we can see in the primary race that some candidates, notably Bernie Sanders, have embraced a small donor strategy where they're really emphasizing their support among everyday working people and are raising small amounts of money from those people. And it ends up having a big impact. But while you have Sanders and Elizabeth Warren leaning into that strategy, you have Buttigieg kind of sticking with business as usual with more traditional fundraising practices that are pretty customary for what we've seen for Democratic candidates over the last few decades, really.
According to Open Secrets, large contributions account for 55% of his fundraising. That's about $42 million. Small contributions account for 44% of his fundraising, $33 million. And according to Buttigieg's campaign, he's got about 730,000 small donors. Average size is $34. You know, the other thing I want to ask you, Sarah, is most people had never heard of Pete Buttigieg last year, and it's pretty incredible that he's been able to raise $75 million and come so close to Bernie Sanders in Iowa and New Hampshire. What do you think explains that?
I think moderates are looking for an alternative to Sanders, and they have several candidates to choose from. Biden no longer looks like quite a sure bet. You know, he did even a few weeks ago, but that's not really true anymore. Warren has been trying to pitch herself as a sort of unity candidate recently, uniting the progressive faction of the party with the more moderate faction of the party. That's not going particularly well. So if you have a lot of money and you don't want to support the Democratic Socialist and you are looking for a candidate to support, I think Buttigieg seems like a charismatic and stable option for those people.
And, you know, we always ask, what do these donors want back for their contribution? And Forbes points out that 13 billionaires have given exclusively to Pete Buttigieg, by far the most of any Democrat running for president. I named some of the names, Jennifer Pritzker, former mm-hmm. Trump supporter. Daryl Roth is the wife of Trump business partner Stephen Roth. She's given to Buttigieg. He's getting some money from finance and investment executives, including hedge fund executives. I mean, to generalize, these are the kinds of people who are fine with social policies like, you know, gay marriage, abortion, gun mm-hmm. control. But when it comes to taxes and really changing the overall structure of the economy, they're definitely more in line with Republicans.
I think that's right. I mean, they may be on board with having their taxes grow up a little bit, but they're not on board with, say, the wealth taxes that have been proposed by Sanders or Warren. And they're donating to Buttigieg because they don't see him as much of a threat to their class interests. So he seems like a safer option for them to invest in. And it really does set up a really sharp contrast between Buttigieg and the rest of the field.
Does anything stand out for you about his tax plan? This is one thing that's not really getting much attention. And so far, what I've been able to read is that he wants to repeal the Trump tax cuts. But that would basically just take us back to where we were a couple of years ago. I mean, Trump brought down the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21%, which is a massive change. So he would bring that mm-hmm. back. Does anything else stand out for you about Buttigieg's tax plan? Have you been able to look into that?
I think the main thing that stands out is that we have actually heard quite a lot about taxes from a lot of different candidates this primary cycle. And as you mentioned, Buttigieg's tax plan would undo some of the damage that the Trump administration has inflicted. But it doesn't go nearly as far as some of the other candidates themselves want to go. And you have, again, the more progressive-leaning candidates talking about taking American tax rates back to what they were even in the 70s and the 80s, where the wealthy were getting taxed more heavily to fund social services. And that doesn't appear to be as much of a priority for Buttigieg.
Yeah, in fact, Bloomberg, not Michael Bloomberg, but Michael Bloomberg's news service, it's just kind of strange to say that, but Bloomberg has a piece, Pete Buttigieg would pay for his $1.5 trillion health care plan by rolling back Trump's corporate tax rate to return to the rate of 35% and allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices. You wrote a bit about his health plan in your piece, Sarah. And Vox also has a piece called Pete Buttigieg's Medicare for All Who Want It plan. And that's what he's calling it on his website, is Medicare for All Who Want It. What really stands out for you on this plan?
Buttigieg has an interesting history with Medicare for All, right? You know, he said on Twitter that he used to be for Medicare for All. And now he says that what he actually supports is Medicare for All Who Want It, which is not the same thing as Medicare for All. So that was a bit interesting. As soon as his presidential campaign picks up a bit of speed, he sort of texts to the right a little bit on a policy he once said that he did support. And, you know, if we're just looking at his donors, I think financially that's paid off for him. And I don't know if it'll be enough to win him the election.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to see him sort of tack to the right like this.
Well, according to Vox, the plan would create an optional government insurance plan into which uninsured people would be automatically enrolled and people with employer-sponsored insurance would be permitted to join. He also wants to expand federal subsidies for private insurance purchased on the Obamacare marketplaces, making them more generous and lifting the Income Eligibility Act, a cap that currently leaves many middle-class families cut off from federal assistance. What I would like to know is, does he support caps on healthcare plans? Because that's what's really gotten people is every year. I mean, my plan has just gone up wildly over the last 5 years. And, you know, people who are in the middle are having a really time paying their premiums.
Right. It's not actually that clear to me whether or not that is something that's in his plan. And, you know, I think that's unquestionably true that his plan would be an improvement on the system we have now. And in fact, I think that's largely true of every candidate in the race, including somebody, for example, like Joe Biden, who is also not a Medicare for All supporter, but wants a public option instead. But it just doesn't go as far as you know, Medicare for All as it's been defined by Sanders, or as, you know, as it's been embraced by the Warren campaign.
The healthcare industry, according to Open Secrets, has given the most to Joe Biden. Pete Buttigieg comes in second, taking home nearly $94,000. His list of donors include executives from Aetna, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Pfizer, and Indiana's Eli Lilly and Company. And the industry does oppose Pete Buttigieg's Medicare for Those Who Want It plan. Sarah, since you wrote about Pete's big donors, what is his relationship like with these people? Because, you know, unlike the candidates who've been around for a long time, I mean, we know that a lot of Democrats go to the homes of very wealthy people. They have, you know, fundraisers with them. The Wine Cave fundraiser got attention in the last debate. But do we know what his relationship is like with these top donors?
We know the most, I think, about his relationship with donors from the tech world. As mayor, he boasted of having a fairly close relationship with Mark Zuckerberg and courted some other Silicon Valley interests as well. So he does seem to have a close relationship on that front. And you know, with some of the other sources of his fundraising, it's a bit hard to tell. It's a bit opaque. The Wine Cave incident, as you mentioned, got a lot of attention. But this is, I think, really the first primary cycle where fundraising practices of that sort have been politically costly at all for candidates like Buttigieg. So I'm sure that he's probably a little bit startled by the position in which he finds himself.
Sarah Jones is a writer at New York Magazine, where she covers politics and culture, and she has written about Pete Buttigieg and his big donors. And Sarah's going to be with us for a few more minutes. So if you have any questions specifically about where his funding is coming from, again, the system that we have with so much money is so obscene. But the fact is, Trump and the Republicans are raising a lot of money, and whoever runs against him is going to have to match him. That's just how the system works right now. But what we're going to do is really follow the money, because who the donors are really makes a difference. And Buttigieg has support from 40 billionaires. 13 are exclusively giving to him. So if you have questions about this or his health care plan, which Sarah has looked at, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Buttigieg is being supported by Vote Vets, and they have a super PAC. They've spent almost $1.7 million supporting him. Brian Sheff, the co-founder and president of the private equity fund Vista Equity Partners, is the group's largest donor. He's given $100,000. Defense policy consultant, I'm not sure what that means exactly, is Matthew Jones. He's a second highest donor at $50,000. And the PAC, several people have donated $5,000, including, let's see, Cigna, Dell, Pfizer, and Edison International. Do you know anything about Vote Vets, Sarah, and why they are supporting Pete Buttigieg?
Yeah, I do know a bit. I mean, Vote Vets really exists to help elect veterans, and so on that basis, Buttigieg qualifies. He's, of course, not the only veteran who's in the primary. Tulsi Gabbard is a veteran as well. But I think, you know, Buttigieg is the more viable of those two candidates, and so he won the support of Vote Vets.
What really strikes you about the people working on his team? The New York Times reports that next month his national policy director, Sonal Shah, who's a veteran of the Obama administration, Google, and Goldman Sachs, is hitting the road to headline events in Virginia, Maryland, and Ohio, where donors are asked for up to $2,800 to become a, quote, champion and join in a policy conversation.
That's so much money. It's just so much money. It's an interesting strategy, for sure, to send out somebody who used to work for Goldman Sachs and to drum up $2,800 from people. And there really is such a significant difference between that strategy and, I keep going back to Bernie Sanders' fundraising strategy, but when we're thinking about the emphasis on small donors, that was something that he did help popularize actually back in 2016. And now we're seeing it being much more common for candidates across the board. But, you know, I understand that given the amount of money that Republicans are able to raise, you know, he needs to raise as much as he can. But I do wonder if this strategy is going to continue to play well for him in the meantime. I have difficulty imagining it resonating outside the sort of circles where you can expect to get $2,800 from a person.
Well, Sarah, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Jones is a writer at New York Magazine. You can find her reporting at yourcallradio.org. And Pete Buttigieg's campaign has released a list of donors who have given more than $25,000. And you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are kicking off a two-week series looking at presidential candidates' records and policy plans. There's so much attention focused on this race, but so much of it is really the horse race. Who's up? Who's down? What's the poll? Now, we're going to talk about donors, records, and policy plans. Joining us now is Melanie Mason, a political reporter for the LA Times covering the presidential race. Melanie has done extensive reporting from South Bend, Indiana, and she's got a number of stories up about Pete Buttigieg and his record. Hi, Melanie. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Kat Redding, who is an activist with Black Lives Matter South Bend. Hi, Kat. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. Well, I want to ask you both, this is not getting much attention. I was just thinking about this morning, putting the show together. Pete Buttigieg was first elected mayor in 2011 when he was just 29 years old. Kat, since you're from South Bend, tell us about that race and why you think Pete Buttigieg won that race.
Well, as we know, you know, the Midwest is populated by majority Democrats. So I hear it all the time that he was the popular vote. Well, he was the Democratic choice. So with the Midwest being mostly the constituents are Democrats, you know, it was given to him.
What do you mean given to him? Was he the only Democrat running or?
I think he was like polling like 80% or something like that in the Midwest. So I think that played a big part of him being nominated as the mayor here in South Bend.
Melanie, did you look into that in your reporting?
A little bit. I think my understanding is that in the Democratic primary, there were actually several other Democrats that were running, and I think that there were some that were more sort of established political names, and you might have had actually kind of a blotting out effect of sort of these sort of better known political figures sort of running against each other. He had also run for state treasurer in Indiana in 2010, the year before he ran for mayor, and got his butt kicked, to put it bluntly. It was Indiana is a Republican state, even though South Bend is a Democratic city, and so he did lose to the Republican there, but South Bend was his base that he was running the statewide campaign, and so I think that that helped build up his name identification and sort of his visibility in the city because he essentially ran two campaigns back-to-back.
So he served as mayor from 2012 January until just recently. He served for 8 years. Melanie, what do we need to know about South Bend, Indiana? In your piece, you say that it's home to about 104,000 people. About 20% live below the poverty line. It's 53% white, 15% Latino, 2% Asian, and 26% Black.
Yeah, I think that the thing that I took away from South Bend was how much, for a very long time, it was a city that was obsessed with its past. I mean, South Bend, during the sort of heyday of the industrial Midwest, in the turn of the 20th century, up towards maybe about the 1950s, 1960s, was really a booming industrial town. You had Studebaker automobiles, you had Singer sewing machines, Bendix brakes, and so you had really good middle-class jobs that were available both for white workers in the city and for African-American workers in the city. I think it's really important also not to be too glossy about what the past was like. There was still institutionalized systemic racism, particularly when it came to things like housing. But I did speak to some of the city's older African-American residents who recalled that those jobs, even if they weren't the best jobs in Studebaker, were available even to the city's African-American residents. And so you saw a lot of prosperity. And then in 1963, Studebaker leaves, and it's this cataclysmic event. The way that I heard residents refer to it was almost like a horror movie. They would call it the event. And for 40 years after that, you really had this sense that South Bend's better days were behind it. And so I think that the theme that I was really exploring when I was talking to residents there was there does seem to be a sense in the last 10 or 15 years, and some of that's attributed to Buttigieg, but not all of it, which I think is important to note, is that there have been a lot of changes in that city and a lot of new energy in that city. But just as we're seeing those changes, I think that there are some very important and fair questions to ask about who is benefiting from those changes.
And just curious, did that Studebaker plant go overseas or did it shut down?
It shut down. So this is unlike, say, what we've seen in maybe GM or Chrysler. But there had been, so, you know, other industrial manufacturers or employers that did relocate overseas. So I think a lot of the trends that we saw in the Midwest more broadly, where you did see because of globalization, because of the changing economy, a lot of these sort of anchor companies that were all throughout the Midwest would pick up stakes and leave, and they would leave a lot of devastation in their wake.
You actually quoted a teacher and activist, Jordan Geiger, who said, "How can South Bend be back when most working families here are struggling, when the school system is failing, when the Black community is in dire straits?" And he's in a photo of a vacant house. Hundreds of vacant homes like the one he's in front of were raised rather than repaired under a Buttigieg initiative. Can you tell us more about that, Melanie?
Yeah, so that was one of the signature initiatives coming in for Mayor Buttigieg was this 1,000 homes in 1,000 days. And the idea was that these homes that were blighted properties that were falling apart would either be repaired or they would be demolished. And I heard a lot of real, quite frankly, mixed reviews about this program. I think that for people that were living next to blighted properties, maybe they were vacant, maybe they felt unsafe, that there was a little bit of relief in maybe removing these eyesores. But as Jordan pointed out to me and other residents did too, you know, these were homes of families and friends, and there were memories in these homes. And so there was a real kind of trauma that some people felt when you saw some of these homes being demolished. I think another fair question about sort of how this program was executed was that there was a lot of code enforcement. And if you're talking about populations that are already dealing with poverty, there's very fair questions about are you giving them opportunities to improve their homes, or is this sort of a punitive measure? It's pretty stunning to be in South Bend now, and you'll walk in these neighborhoods, and to me, these empty lots stuck out almost like missing teeth, right? Mm-hmm. So you would see the empty expanses of land where there used to be homes, and I think it's important to remember that, as Jordan pointed out, those used to be homes of people that they knew. And so I think that even though people feel some relief in maybe not having some of these blighted properties around anymore, it's certainly a lot of mixed emotions.
Kat, can you tell us how this policy affected you and your community?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question once more?
We were talking about the program to knock down hundreds of homes in mostly Black and Latino neighborhoods. Can you talk about how that affected you and your community?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's important to keep in mind that with housing and ownership, that presents generational wealth. And if you're removing these houses and with aggressive code enforcement violations, and as we know, these areas are already poverty stricken. So if we have these homes that are, you know, condemned or not being kept up to code, and you're penalizing the owner, and if they're not able to fix the house due to poverty, then what will make you think that they could fix the houses under these codes? You know, like I think it was just definitely a telltale sign of how the conditions are in South Bend. You know, we have a high poverty rate, unemployment rate, and things like that, and then you have these code enforcement people that's going into these neighborhoods that are already poverty stricken, and you're given these code violations, and instead of Pete having an initiative to help out the minorities to fix these houses up, to get them up to code at least, they were ultimately fined and removed, you know. So these houses were you know, torn down due to, you know, these code violations. And as I said before, this
is a telltale sign of where the generational wealth is here in South Bend.
Now, this plan called for 1,000 vacant and abandoned homes to be bulldozed or repaired within 1,000 days. So were any of these homes actually repaired?
No, not to our understanding. There were some that were supposed to be repaired, but ended up ultimately on the demolition list. I'm not sure where the ball was dropped, but the initiative for the houses to be repaired, that never happened.
Melanie?
Some folks that I spoke to in certain neighborhoods, one of the neighborhoods is this near Northwest neighborhood, which is pretty close actually to where Pete Buttigieg lives. The folks that do affordable housing there did say that there were some homes that were repaired. And in fact, that was, you know, sort of a sign of victory, or defeat, right? That there was almost a sense of defeat if a home had to be demolished as opposed to, repaired. I think that there was a sense, at least among local housing activists, that the preference would be to repair these homes. But again, I think that the most telltale sign are these vacancies, because that's where you see the lack of home, and it really does stand out.
I just wanted to keep in mind that there was, I think, a $25,000 budget for home repairs, but due to the mass amount of the homes that were under violation, that $25,000 wasn't enough to stretch, you know, for real repairs, you know, that can actually stand out.
That is Kat Redding. Kat is an activist with Black Lives Matter in South Bend, Indiana. Melanie Mason is a political reporter with the Los Angeles Times who has been writing extensive pieces about former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg and his time there. He spent 8 years as mayor. He just recently finished his time as mayor there. Today we are talking about Pete Buttigieg's record, his policies, and his donors. We're kicking off a 2-week series looking at all of the candidates' records and policies. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW 91.7. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us. Our handle is @yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are kicking off a series looking at presidential candidates' records and policy plans. Tomorrow we'll be talking about Bernie Sanders, and then on Thursday we'll talk about Elizabeth Warren. Today we are talking about former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. If you have any questions about his policies, his record, his donors, we'd love to hear from you. We've got Kat Redding, an activist with Black Lives Matter in South Bend, Indiana. So she actually lives there. So if you have questions for Kat about what happened under Pete Buttigieg's 8 years as mayor, what changed, what didn't change. Melanie Mason is a political reporter at the LA Times, and she has been doing extensive reporting in South Bend. You can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. You can call us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You can tweet us at yourcallradio. Kat, since you do live in South Bend, what else really stands out for you? I mean, the thing that, you know, a lot of people are complaining about the media coverage because it's about the horse race, it's about the polls, you know, who's up, who's down, you've got the talking heads. The real issues are really lacking from a lot of the coverage. So what do you think is missing from the coverage, given that you live in South Bend?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that we have a real police crisis here in South Bend, that... you know, that we had a murder, Eric Logan, by the South Bend Police Department. And after that, nothing's really been done. We're still waiting on a verdict as to where the special prosecutor stands on the police officer. I believe the name O'Neill. We're still waiting for a civilian review board with subpoena power. We are, you know, definitely forging on to try to see if there's any mental health resources here in South Bend, because we have a crisis and an epidemic with that. We just, you know, lost one of our community members, actually a leader in our community, due to mental health issues. Mm. And these are underlying issues that haven't been addressed. And those are the things that hasn't been really blatant in the media most recent.
It's gotten some coverage in the print media. The New York Times had a piece called Pete Buttigieg Leaves Campaign Trail After Police Killing of a Black Man in South Bend. This ran last June. And there was another, and I just want to name the man, Eric Logan, 54, was shot at 3:30 a.m. after the police responded to a report of a person rifling through cars downtown. This is according to the prosecutor's office. And then there was another story. In fact, you were quoted in this New York Times piece, Kat. Did Pete Buttigieg help black people in South Bend? So what can you tell us about Buttigieg's relationship with groups like Black Lives Matter and police?
Well, from what I can say is, you know, he's avoided the FOP as well as Black Lives Matter. We've sat down with him after the killing of Eric Logan, and we were just trying to figure out, you know, where would the community go from that point on. We wanted to try to remedy the situation with implicit bias training and updated training for the police department. After sitting in to many advisory meetings allocated by the mayor after the killing of Eric Logan, we found out that the South Bend Police Department each officer is not equally yoked, that each officer has come in on different trainings. Some have received the most recent training, while other older officers have not received updated training. So we thought that was very alarming and concerning, that we have veterans of 20 years at the police department not even turning on their body cams. We find it very alarming that Eric Logan was not transported to the hospital in an ambulance, that he was put in the back of a squad car after being shot in his stomach twice. The relationship right now with blacks and Mayor Pete in South Bend is not really good at this time, because we have a lot of margins that were supposed to be taken care of that were not addressed at all. We have these policies that he's spoken on and left behind. We have the Douglas Plan, for instance, that he'd like to implement or speak on his presidential campaign. But those things could have been more effective here in his city, and it would have vindicated him, and it would have left the city more supportive in with him of him during his campaign.
And you mentioned the Douglas Plan. I just want to read from his website in case people aren't familiar with this. This is according to Pete Buttigieg's website. The Douglas Plan is a comprehensive and intentional dismantling of racist structures and systems, combined with an equally intentional and affirmative investment of unprecedented scale in the freedom and self-determination of Black Americans. Melanie, what else can you tell us about this Douglas Plan?
I think that Buttigieg, like a lot of the presidential candidates, have been much more active than at least in past presidential cycles in sort of calling out systemic racism in this country and trying to tackle it from a variety of viewpoints. So, for example, I think a lot of times when people are talking about racial justice in this country, the first conversation is around criminal justice, and that's obviously a very important conversation, and that's something that Pete Buttigieg, for example, has talked about cutting the population of incarcerated people in half, reclassifying certain types of crimes so that they're not crimes that require incarceration. But then there's also conversations around health care, where there's such disparate outcomes in, for example, maternal health between Black and Latino women as opposed to white women when it comes to childbirth, or when it comes to home ownership, which, of course, with the legacy of redlining that we've had in this country, there have been systemic barriers for that entering of the housing market and that accumulation of generational wealth. So the Douglas plan that Buttigieg has put out, he's sort of framing it as a way to sort of tackle all of these issues all at once, things like Black entrepreneurship, other things. And I think some of his challenges have been less in the policy proposals themselves, but in parts of the rollout. And I think that in particular that his campaign put out a list of supporters in South Carolina, African-American leaders, that then said that that was sort of mischaracterizing. This was not an endorsement of Buttigieg. And so there's been a little bit of, as one person characterized to me, two steps forward, five steps back. When it comes to engaging on the minority community, that there are benefits to the policies that he's proposing, but there's been some issues when it comes to actually the rollout of such policies.
I mean, his bullet points on his website are very impressive. I mean, any person who cares about these issues, especially the horrific rates of people of color and poor people in jail, would embrace these. He writes, "We'll double funding for federal grants for states that commit to criminal justice reform on the federal level, eliminate incarceration for drug possession, reduce sentences for other drug offenses and apply these reductions retroactively, eliminate mandatory minimums, commute the sentences of people who are incarcerated in the federal system beyond what justice warrants by establishing an independent clemency commission that sits outside the DOJ, abolishing federal, private federal prisons." I mean, this is what, you know, abolitionist activists and people who are working on this issue have been calling for years. But Kat raises a good question. You know, Pete just finished his mayoral term in January. So, you know, her question, Melanie, is why didn't he apply some of these policies to South Bend?
And I think that's an important and fair question. And I think that one of the things that we've seen is first of all, the questions of sort of where the levers of power are, depending on where you are in sort of the ranks of government, right? So obviously, as mayor of South Bend, there's very little that he could do when it comes to, say, private prisons or even, you know, the certain classifications of crimes. But he did get asked in a debate recently about the arrest rates for African-Americans when it comes to marijuana crimes. And that was a difficult moment for him. He actually had a hard time sort of understanding or explaining why it appears that Black residents of South Bend had been arrested at much higher rates than white residents. He did form a committee. I'm going to sort of forget the exact phrasing of it, but it was to sort of evaluate the racial wealth gap in the city. There was a report that the city put out on this, and in fact, sometimes you hear some maybe frustration from the campaign that some of the numbers that are being pointed to now, where it shows some of these disparities, we only know those numbers because the Buttigieg administration actually put that report together. But I think that there is a fair question of, was that enough? Was there enough emphasis in tackling those disparities? Having that data is important, but it's what you do with that data that really is where you should judge people.
Kat, what are your thoughts on that? What would you add?
Well, yeah, I think the disparity studies was definitely something to put on the record, but I don't think that there actually had to be a study for $101 million that was only 1% allocated to minority contractors. I don't think that had to be a study. There was like $700 that was allocated to, you know, a minority contract. I don't think that had to be a study, you know. I think that it's really upfront, and it speaks volumes to, you know, just the man that Mayor Pete is, you know. Like, he brings up all these good points. You know, he's aware of the, you know, arrest rates for Blacks due to marijuana and things like that. But these are things that happened under his administration. So when you look at that, then he was very aware and he was very in the knowing of what was going on, but he just chose to turn a blind eye to that. And it's important that the world knows that, you know, this man, you know, he does make good bullet points and he's very charismatic and he does speak on white supremacy and things like that. But when it's time to put those words to action, Pete is not a man of action.
Well, and what you're talking about with the contractors, The Intercept had a piece by Akella Lacey, and she writes, one of the main tenets of Pete Buttigieg's plan to address racial inequality is a proposal to increase the number of federal contracting dollars going to women and minority-owned businesses to 25%. But in South Bend, Indiana, less than 3% of city business contracts have gone to minority and women-owned businesses in recent years. That's what you're talking about, Kat. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Well, that is, we're talking today with Kat Redding, an activist with Black Lives Matter South Bend, Indiana. Melanie Mason is a political reporter with the Los Angeles Times, where she has spent a lot of time covering Pete Buttigieg and his record as mayor. If you have any questions for Kat or Melanie, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You know, it's so interesting, Kat, because as you said, there's all these grand plans, but what are these people, what have these politicians actually done? And we just did a show about the racial justice records and plans. A scorecard just came out from Urban. I have to grab the name of this organization. I want to get this right. I'll get the name in just a minute. But I just want to say, so Pete Buttigieg got a B+. And they talk about his Douglas plan sticking out. They say it's one of the strongest and most comprehensive plans for racial justice. You know, they talk about the plan's mission. They talk about him wanting to give money to historically Black colleges and universities to promote greater teacher diversity. I mean, the list is really long. Your argument is these are great plans, but what he's saying doesn't match what he did in South Bend. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been quoted before to say this, like, Pete's handshake just doesn't match his charismatic smile, you know. And it's these great ideas that he has would have been, with a population of 100,000 here in South Bend, would have been good to see if these are actually effective to take to the next level as to, you know, presidency is considered. Any of these things, you know, I believe with, you know, the police department, giving us the Civilian Review Board, removing Chief Ruskowski, who is, you know, the cause of promoting officers who have discrepancies or write-ups due to asphyxiation. One officer murdered a Black man by sticking a straw down his throat. And these are supposed to be our first responders. We should know that if someone swallows something, then the best thing that you could do is give them the Heimlich maneuver. You know, these are the men that Pete allowed to stay in power and leave us to deal with, you know. So, you know, yeah, absolutely. I think that Pete's ideas are wonderful, but I think far as when it comes to implementing any of these policies, he's dropped the ball.
Melanie, when you talk to people about these issues, about these, you know, incredible policy plans that he has versus what he did in South Bend, Indiana, just over the last 8 years, what did you hear?
Well, I think, again, we have to sort of take a look at where South Bend was and sort of also the sort of playing field that we're talking about. And so I think that there are very legitimate and important and vital conversations to be having now that he is running to be president of the United States, about sort of how his plans sort of would, you know, what his commitment to such plans would be. I think in South Bend, a lot of the conversations that I had were kind of about the more, a lot of sort of day-to-day sort of changes or improvements or frustrations about the sort of lack of improvements that really is under the purview of a mayor. In fact, it was interesting to see, you know, Joe Biden put out a digital ad a couple of weeks ago that was hitting Pete Buttigieg for doing things like installing, you know, colored lights underneath the fountains, I'm sorry, underneath the bridges across the St. Joseph River as a sort of a revitalization improvement project. But that's actually something I heard quite a bit from residents, was things like the parks being improved, public spaces being improved, the downtown where the streets used to all be one ways, almost kind of thoroughfares, were changed into a sort of more conventional two-way streets, which led to more businesses being flourishing there and sort of more pedestrian life there. So I think that part of the question that he now faces as he's running for president is how much his experiences in South Bend as a mayor have prepared him for what is a very different job running for president. But what struck me actually being in South Bend was how much sort of the evaluation of his tenure really is based on sort of these municipal questions of quality of life issues.
Kat, what are your thoughts about that? How have you seen your city change and who has really benefited from it?
Well, yeah, I mean, we just spoke briefly on the disparity studies here in South Bend. And it's nice that we have these smart streets, but if we have less than 3% contractors, minority contractors here in the city, and if we don't have small businesses that are owned by minorities, then who is benefiting from these smart streets? Who is benefiting from anything, the lights under the bridge? You know, I think it's important to question those things, because if we have a high poverty rate and a high unemployment rate, and we don't have the contractors, the minority contractors that we need to, you know, get this, these funds allocated to, then that tells you, that paints a picture for you of as to where the economic stances are here in South Bend with the Black community. We're impoverished, you know, and, you know, it's frustrating, because I think that everyone here in the city of South Bend wanted to support Mayor Pete, wanted to, you know, give him the vote for presidency, and we wanted to send him off vindicated and advocated and spoken for by the people of his city as his constituents. But ultimately, we just feel as if, you know, the Black and brown community were forgotten about, and also the oppression of supremacy continues here in South Bend, because we have now only have a voice because we have national coverage on us and on our city now. But our voices have been suppressed for so long, to the point as to we don't know where we're going. So we're just hoping for, you know, the new mayor to make the changes that's necessary with allocating mental health finances and, you know, helping these contractors to become these subcontractors, you know, ultimately they're subcontractors to become contractors to, you know, be able to allocate money within the city, within these poverty-stricken areas, and giving us the resources that's necessary to thrive. And when I have the question asked so many times as to what is it that Black people want from their mayor or president, and we want the same things as the white people have. We want good schools. We want jobs. We want, you know, insurance. We want, you know, education. We want housing. We want affordable housing. We want ownership. We want the very same things that were denied from us due to redlining, due to the Homestead Act, due to, you know, all these things that has put us 400 years behind the curve, and these supremacists that are sitting in these leadership roles right now are seeing to it that these Jim Crow laws are still affecting us still to this day. So we just want the things that are promised to our counterparts, you know?
Right. Well, it's sad that that has to be said, Kat, but that makes so much sense. I also wanted to ask you, as we're near the end of the show, what about the homeless population in South Bend? What happened with the homeless population under Pete Buttigieg? Jacobin has a piece, and they say that the city's homeless population has been subject to arrests and the placement of "do not give to panhandlers" signs on street corners.
Yeah, that's the reality here in South Bend. I don't know if you're aware of this, but, you know, we have the highest eviction rate here in South Bend throughout Indiana. So you have people that we have these grassroots organizations that a few, but to name one is like Food Not Bombs. They're standing out on the street corners to feed the homeless because, you know, there's not a, you know, these programs that, people are waiting on waiting lists, you know, and they're freezing by the river, like dying. We have a population, we've lost two, I believe, homeless men this winter, you know, due to the fact because of these waiting lists, and they say, oh, well, they didn't want to get help, you know, and things like that, or they didn't want to get clean and things like that. That's where I say we need those mental health resources. We need these centers to rehabilitate, you know, these drug influences that people have in their lives. You know, no man or woman, you know, in their right mind is going to choose to sleep out in the cold. You know, that's a mental health, you know, issue. That is a drug issue, you know, that they're being afflicted by, you know. So these are things that need to be, you know, addressed. You know, we need to get these community health care workers out here in the community and, you know, really gather this data, the real data in these streets by talking to our neighbors and talking to our neighborhood leaders and really come up with solutions, not just talk about it like Pete likes to do, you know, as he did, you know, like let's really put a formula together for success.
And those signs, I should say, came from a group called Downtown South Bend. They read, "Do not give to panhandlers, contribute to the solution." And the New Yorker's Charles Bethia has a piece, "What Pete Buttigieg Has and Hasn't Done About Homelessness in South Bend." He writes, 2 years ago, a working group published plans to address what was seen as a growing problem. Critics say the mayor's office has been slow to act. And we'll put that piece up at yourcallradio.org. Melanie, final thoughts from you. Any other critical issue that people should know about that hasn't gotten as much attention as it should?
I think that the biggest takeaway that I had from being in South Bend is, you know, the act of a city sort of reinventing itself is really hard. And I think that for all of the sort of optimism and energy that you see from the fact that there are new companies that are coming in, I think that there is some really fair and important questions about, are those changes being felt equally throughout the city? And so I do think, and I think that this is a question, quite frankly, that predates Buttigieg and is going to outlast him now that he's not mayor anymore. This is a city that went through 40 years of a really rough patch. And so I think now when we're trying to evaluate the 10 to 15 years that have happened recently, I think that it is important to sort of contextualize where that has come from. And I do think that it is obviously a city we are paying a lot of attention to because Pete Buttigieg is running for president, and so there's been a lot of glare. But I actually think that it's a question that applies to a lot of cities, particularly in the Midwest, who have found themselves down their luck as the changing economy has happened. And I think that as cities are trying to sort of figure out what their next sort of identity is, the question of who gets to share in that identity, who gets to shape it, and who gets to benefit from it, those are questions that are incredibly tricky. And South Bend is a really good example of both the pros and the cons of that sort of reinvention process.
Melanie Mason is a political reporter at the LA Times. She spent a lot of time in South Bend writing about Pete Buttigieg and his time as mayor. Melanie, thanks for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Kat Redding is an activist with Black Lives Matter, South Bend, Indiana. Kat, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Joanne Marr, our studio engineer. We're going to be talking about all of the candidates, records, policies, and donors over the next 2 weeks. Tomorrow, it's Bernie Sanders, and Thursday, it's Elizabeth Warren. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. We'll be right back.